while I've been there, and I don't know, I haven't heard any history of it. What's theoretically possible is they go ahead and defend themselves and establish that they were acting officially. They can sue the state back for their defense costs and so forth. But we've never had one on its head.
Okay.
It may have happened sometime in the past.
Well, no, I'm just wondering whether this change would make any possible difference.
No, if we turn somebody loose, they'll have their shot at us if they want it.
We've left the existing language intact. I think it's lines 36, 37, 38, and 39.
Okay.
We've left that language intact. One last comment on this section 6. I want you to be aware that this really was initiated by General Services and not at the request of the Attorney General's office. So it is our concern that we're dealing with. And the group of attorneys, which all of you represent, deal with a variety of legal principles, which I am not expert in, obviously. So I'm speaking as the layman dealing with my responsibilities for cost containment.
I will don't make speeches about the legislature. Is that part of your point?
I would offer a second reason from my standpoint that I am concerned about. We obviously do have state employees who act inappropriately and outside your expectations and your authorizations, but we also have many, many employees who do the very best they can and do a good job for the taxpayers. For us to not be able to tell those employees, as in the Bradford Davis case, you did act properly, we will defend you, causes those good state employees to be very conservative in their conduct and fail to take risks when it is expected of them and in some cases expected by this legislative assembly. So the extent to which we don't provide that security blanket, it does act as a severe caution in employees carrying out your expectations. Item 7.
Can I just ask one question on this section?
Senator
Henderson. Or maybe for Mr. Long. How would this make us stand compared to other states' indemnity for their public officials? If the majority of the states have the kind of policy that you're suggesting, are we out of step with them, or do most of them have the kind of policy that?
I can't answer that because I haven't looked. I think there are still some few states that are resting on sovereign immunity. Believe it or not,
I'm sure there's not too many of those left.
Two or three, I think. And many states, I do know, are still in the private insurance business, which is even more complicated. One thing that I wanted to make a point of is we haven't changed the fact that if you do a really bad act, if you do a malicious act, or an act with intention to cause harm, or something that's grossly reckless, which you know can just involve an uncaring state of mind, there's still individual personal liability. So I don't think state officials, legislators, they're not going to run out and do anything untoward because they have a free insurance policy.
The other thing I wanted to ask you is, this will also affect not just state officers, but county and city, and so will affect their, or won't it? And if you're changing Chapter 30, where it says the governing body of any public body shall defend.
Are
the provisions only dealing with...
with the AG.
So this will not be affecting counties and cities and their insurance funds.
It is not our intention to make any changes with respect to local government.
It's the Attorney General's determination of coverage that's at issue here. We actually talked to some local people about whether they were concerned or not concerned, and... The last word I got from the people I talked to was, well, they were considering it. They don't know quite what to do with it. They don't have the same kinds of problems that we do because they don't administer the federal programs we do. The worst case that I can think of where this is a potential issue is a case where everybody admits that the public officials are doing what this legislature told them to do. Moreover, they're doing what the federal agency that administers the federal law is telling them to do, but the federal court has said both the federal agency and the state are wrong. And here stands the employee going, you know, what am I supposed to do? I'm doing what the state law says, and I'm doing what the federal supervisory agency says to do, and the federal court says now that I'm wrong. Well, that's a person we'd like to tell right off the bat, you're covered. You can forget it.
How could they be wrong, though? In sense, they'd have to be out of the course and scope of their employment.
No, the federal court said the federal agency's interpretation of federal law was wrong.
And with that, they would have personal liability?
They can.
Under what theory would they have personal liability?
On the theory that the plaintiff's lawyers have advised both the federal agency and the state agency ahead of time that their interpretation of the regulations were invalid. They'll never make it on personal liability in this one. They have got a declaration that the regulatory scheme is invalid, but they're not seeking personal damages. But, you know, they're not after the employees in that instance. But that kind of situation is very common for state practice. And if they made a claim for punitive damages, they could probably, I hate to say that.
I just find it hard to believe that any jury would award personal liability against an official that was carrying, in good faith, was carrying out policies.
I hope you're
right. Are there any cases where they ever have awarded?
We've won them all to this point. We won them to this point. And you're right, this is something that looks to the future. We don't want it to happen, and we don't want to be stuck and say, even though we think you're right, everybody thinks you're right, you have to pay.
Mr. Chairman, I think the whole arena of the federal civil rights is what gives us the concern today. We have the indemnities, or the statutory limits that the legislature has established as it relates to state functions, but half of the programs that state government operates have federal funds in them, and the federal civil rights provisions.
This doesn't have anything to do with the class action lawsuit in higher education.
No.
That's what I was going to ask. Does this affect any pending litigation?
There aren't personal claims, as I recall.
In which? In Pink?
I don't think so. My recollection is that they're not seeking.
No, no personal claims there. All the relief is asserted against the state as a whole.
Yeah.
Yeah. Chairman?
Senator Frye.
I have two or three questions. I think that the. I like the bill. I like especially the omission of what is currently subsection 6 of 30.285. I don't know how in the world that ever got in there, and leaving these public employees hanging out if their claims rejected. So I'm glad to see that. But Stan, what is the practice now with claims involving deputy district attorneys? Because I notice that they're not included in the defense umbrella here.
It's kind of an anomalous situation in the law. The current wisdom, institutional lore, and some attorney general's opinions. District attorneys are state officials. The reason why district attorneys are state officials is that they're provided for in the Constitution, although they're subject to your control because of the amendment to Article 7. Deputy DAs are understood to be county officials. That's why you set DA salaries and fund DA salaries, but you give deputy DAs a supplement.
Mr. Chair, but don't they have judicial immunity to some degree, too?
Prosecutorial immunity, yes.
From suit? So they're not as vulnerable?
When a deputy DA gets into a hot spot, usually, you see the county defending them. If it's the district attorney, we defend them. Okay. Now you end up with both in the case, because what the deputy did may be what the district attorney said to do.
What happens when you have a case like in Marion County? Wasn't the AG that was prosecuting the district attorney?
Yes, we did that.
Then what did you do for the defense? Subcontracted out?
No, that was what I was speaking to was a criminal case, of course, and we don't have any part in the defense of that one.
So you wouldn't have a situation where you'd be on both sides on a civil?
No. All right, so anyway, that's deputies are taken care of
on the county.
A little different way. All right, now, just a technical question, I suppose, or observation. If you look at line 26 on page 3, could I suggest that the... the first thing I'd do, I would make 30.285 subsection 3 instead of 5, but I suppose you can argue about that one way or the other. But whether you leave it at subsection 5 or you change it to 3, I would certainly suggest that the rest of that language on lines 26, 27, and 28 are unnecessary. Why don't we just say that payment can be made or settlement can be made unless the defense has been rejected by the Attorney General pursuant to this other section over here, because that other section already says on lines 22 through 24 on page 2 that the AG can reject the defense if these acts or omissions were amounted to such and such. The same things we find on page 3. Mm. So I'm just wondering about really the necessity even of that language on page 3.
I see your point. I guess what I'd like to do is sit down in my office for a minute or two and look at it, and if it could be amended, bring it back to you.
There's a reason for that. Mr. Chairman, I did not get to Section 7 yet. Stan has talked a little bit about that, but let me tell you the background behind Section 7. We are concerned about the issue of punitive damages stemming from a federal civil rights case where an employee acted within the expected course of duties. Let's say they're carrying out a legislative mandate, just to roll it back to something of interest that you would have as legislative assembly, carrying out a legislative mandate that is then found to have been so grossly improper by a federal court that they do in fact award punitive damages.
That could only be a federal policy, not a state one.
Well, we're concerned about that. Now, I don't think we have, to my knowledge, we do not have one of these pending right now. But this whole area of federal civil rights, and I will say from a layman's perspective, is so invading the policy discretion of both the state legislative and state executive branches that we have concerns. I'm not talking about higher education. I'm talking about mental health programs, foster care programs, the human services programs that we deliver. And what we intended...
Prison.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Which, if there's a riot out there, suddenly will have been dangerously overcrowded. The facts,
yeah.
History will suddenly flop.
That's right. And
our
concern
will have been bad.
Our concern with lines.
History always seems to be. You know, they always judge it in aftersight.
And our concern that caused lines 26, 27, and 28 were not in concert with Section 6. It was intended to give us a little broader discretion to be sure that we could pay those punitive damages if they were awarded, just to be quite candid with you. Mm-hmm. And the test that we preferred to use was if it was malicious, if it was intentional.
Okay, now I see the point now.
Is where we were coming from.
I see the point. I know exactly where you wanted the language in there. Now my question is, and I think the question of the committee ought to be, is that a determination that we think your department ought to be able to make, or should we leave that up to the Attorney General? If you take those words out, then it's going to be up to the Attorney General.
Okay.
That's where I'd be inclined to go myself.
And I have no objection with that resting in the Attorney General's office. But somebody needs that broad authority.
Senator Gardner. There isn't any public policy prohibition that a federal court would enforce against insurance of punitive damages awards like this, is there?
Yeah, it's a good question. We talked about that a little bit and did a little work on the subject. I think the candid answer to your question is it's possible.
What?
You know what the federal courts have done with state immunities that they don't like. About the only thing that the state, that the federal government adopts out of our Tort Claims Act is the statute of limitations, and that's only the Ninth Circuit. The U.S. Supreme Court hasn't spoken to that. They don't like the notice provision. They say it's inconsistent with the federal policy, et cetera.
They don't like the 180 day.
Yeah, they don't like the 180 days, and they don't like the limit. You know, to heck with your limits. The only thing that maybe cuts the other way is, from a plaintiff lawyer's perspective that would be pushing that issue, why would they push it?
I think the court would do it sua sponte.
Yeah, well, it hadn't happened yet, but...
I just wonder if there's any learning in that, or any... there are cases involving purchase of insurance against punitive damages,
yes.
And I can't remember...
Oh, you mean a taxpayer lawsuit?
No, they're private cases about, you know, about whether you can insure against punitive damages generally.
Yes, there are.
And that's really what we're doing. We're insuring against punitive damages. I can't remember how those came out, though.
Well, at one point in the history, they clearly came out that you couldn't do it, that it was against public policy to sell the policy. Now they're regularly sold, and the conventional wisdom today is that you can't do it. Here, you're in a little bit stronger position because you're saying, well, what the state pays and what its official pays individually is a matter of state law.
Mm-hmm.
We're not deciding about liability or compensation to the plaintiff.
It's up to us to apportion that,
sure,
as we see fit.
And we're apportioning it, and you know, we're writing the terms of our insurance policy.
Tell me a little more about the policy here in this language that Senator Fry just brought up.
Section 7?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's all right. Let me say this. I considered that point. at least in one conversation with Mr. Rawls, the way the program operates now, we make certain decisions jointly, and those decisions typically are the money decision. You know, if you say who's decided to settle the case, it's pretty hard to pin that down, because on a big item involving a lot of money, we offer our legal opinion about the merits of the case. They offer some guidance and advice about how that case looks compared with others and how they feel about spending that amount of money. And a decision comes out of that relationship, which is not much different than a lawyer and an insurance company. I'm not uncomfortable with General Services having that authority, although it tends to look like in the abstract a legal decision. It's really an economic decision and a legal decision. I don't think General Services would, at least under Mr. Rawls, make that decision on their own. And it's your pleasure, and I will tell you this, if you change the language and put it in the Attorney General's office, we're still going to talk to him about the money and say, how do you feel about it? The legislature did that, and I think wisely. The risk management program used to be in the Attorney General's office before I was there, and I got to be involved in starting with the program when it was being separated. I think it works pretty well. It's working pretty well right now. With they've got their eye primarily on the money, and we've got our eye primarily on the legal issues. And we knock heads once in a while, but most of the time we get the right result.
From General Services' perspective, Senator, the Justice Department defines the scope and nature of duties of an employee, and we are bound by that determination. We make the settlements. We do, in fact, decide whether to settle a case before a judicial determination is made. Now, we are required statutorily to consult with the Attorney General on that determination. The objective of lines 2627, as I've already indicated, were to broaden our flexibility a little bit to cover these gray areas of punitive damages. There are two reasons under which we would not make that type of settlement. If defense was rejected, we could not make a settlement. We would have no authority in our shop to make such a settlement. But if defense was not rejected, then we would have authority to settle, in some cases settle before a judicial determination was made. That's an important step in the process. But I don't object to any additional legal oversight by the Justice Department in this area, if it's an important issue to you. But I think we've, in Senate Bill 131, we covered that ground for 3 months.
Okay. But thank you very much. We do have to move on. We need to have another hearing on this bill because we got more witnesses and we've spent almost an hour on just starting. Does anyone have any other questions right now? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Very helpful. Don Sutherland, Safe Corporation.
Mr. Chairman, senators, and staff, my name is Don Sutherland. I represent Safe Corporation. Safe favors the exclusion of workers' compensation insurance from Section 2, Subsection 1, which authorizes the Department of General Services to provide insurance coverage. This language is in conflict with ORS 656017-2, which provides that the state shall insure its employees for workers' compensation through Safe. Safe also favors the exclusion of workers' compensation from the authority asked for in Section 3, which gives the Department of General Services authority to set terms, conditions, and procurement methods. Here again, this would seem to be in conflict with 656017-2. Since 7176, SAFE has provided coverage to the state at the lowest net rates possible. These have been flat rates for each agency with no premium built in for premium discount or dividends. The advance rating for individual agencies was terminated 6/30/76. Currently, state rates are about 96% of the NCCI's calculated pure premium rates. SAFE must cover the balance of the claim costs and all administrative expense from investment earnings. If, as it appears probable, General Services should desire to short-stop and hold part of the workers' compensation premium, SAFE would not accrue the expected investment income and would have to raise its rates to the state. Finally, routing workers' compensation premium through General Services, as provided in Section 4, would appear to add another level of administration to its attendant costs.
What is your main concern about General Services becoming the...
Well, I think the possibility exists in the language in the law there that they could self-insure. And naturally, we want to protect our turf.
That's real clear.
There's no objection on any of our part for the risk management element that Mr. Rawls has spoken of. That's a needed thing.
I don't think this permits them to self-insure.
Pardon?
I don't think this permits them to self-insure.
The language would seem to indicate that that is a possibility.
Yeah, but we have the other statutory provisions that require explicitly that they insure with SAVE.
Not being an attorney, I'm never clear on whether the last thing you pass takes precedent or whether they all have to
work. They have to be construed in peri materia, which means unless they're flatly inconsistent, they have to be construed so as to render them consistent. And they clearly are consistent.
So that's no problem.
I don't know. We can have the legislative intent be clear that there's no intent to allow them to self-insure.
They take the money that they were spending giving it to SAFE and keep it.
Right.
But that's not enough to start an insurance company.
Well, I don't know. Monty Montgomery's starting one down there.
Do they have a reserve?
Just surprised what you do for the dividend.
Yeah.
A little dividend there, a little dividend there.
There are
two ways, I gather, for self-insurance. One is a trusting to a reserve, and the other is trusting to luck, which do they do?
You might
have. Would you repeat that?
I said something about two ways of self-insuring. One is kind of trusting to a reserve, which you fund and have invested, waiting for your Lusitania to sink, and the other they just trust to luck.
Maybe they think they're going to get some of that $86 million back.
Well,
would you give us more information on this? And you've got a lot of lawyers in SAFE, aren't you?
I beg your pardon, Senator?
You've got a lot of lawyers in SAFE. Would you give us a little more information on this if you'd like? We don't want to...
Pardon? Yeah, he's your testimony.
They charge... Thank you.
What I'm telling you is, sir, we aren't going to dismiss what you said, but we'd like more information. We aren't quite sure that it has the danger that you think it might. But
any specific area?
Well, the question is whether or not they might self-insure.
Okay.
So I think the members are telling you that right now they don't think that danger is there, but if you still think it is, you should give us more information.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone here from the insurance commissioner's office? There's some written testimony. Did you want to testify? Or were you just here to observe? I don't want to...
Senator Waters, I think the member of the committee...
Would you give your name for the tape?
Warren Pendlebury, the chief insurance examiner for the state of Oregon. And there was a written...
We
have your written testimony, yes.
Yeah, I don't know if there's anything varied from that.
If you'd signed up, would you have checked in the for or against column or right on the line?
How about the middle?
In the middle.
Well, I don't think we're either for or against it. It's just a matter of information that's contained in the paper.
Well, Senator Gardner.
Do you read this thing the same way that the prior witness does, that this bill permits self-insurance programs?
I believe that's the point that we really addressed the position paper to, is that it appeared as though the state was about to embark on a number of self-insurance programs. And I believe that was kind of inferred when they said they'd hire more actuaries and more people and more technical experts.
Well, we got to be clear about what... Whether or not I don't think that's Darrell's intent, but we got to be clear. If you're an expert in the insurance area, if that's ambiguous to you, you better clarify that.
It appeared as though that's the direction that this bill appeared to be going, but again, we don't, as far as the insurance commissioner's office is concerned, if the state wants to embark on self-insurance programs, that's
not the question. I want to know whether this bill is so ambiguous in your professional view, that it would have permit that, because we got to be clear about what we're... I don't think it does, but we got to make sure we're clear about the fact that it doesn't permit that.
Yeah, there's this language. You know, really, that it could develop and administer self-insurance programs.
Yeah, it seems really expensive.
To purchase insurance bond.
Everybody is granted to the department, et cetera, et cetera.
I really don't want to take all day on this one bill, so I think we'd better get more information from the three agencies that have testified and I
believe the way we read it, it indicated that there would be additional self-insurance program.
Okay.
But again, appreciate your, the legislature.
Appreciate this, you're helping us, and I'm sure, would you get back to us about it some more so we can learn more about this?
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Now, while we're all here, most of us, we've got six of the seven here, we've got two rather short things to do on work session. I'd like to do that before our day gets away from us. I'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 42 and open the work session on Senate Bill 130. And we have in our file, this was the nasty notice bill, and we will recall we wanted to see what the notice actually was, and here it is. The support enforcement people, when they send this notice out, get a lot of angry phone calls back, and they thought maybe it would be a good idea to do away with the notice without seeing that some of us were saying, well, gee, maybe the reason, the fact that you're getting these nasty phone calls indicates you've finally gotten somebody's attention. So if we don't think this notice is too nasty, or we think it's just about nasty enough, I would suggest we table the bill, but if we think it's really objectionable or couldn't be rewritten,
Mr. Chair, just to refresh my memory on this bill, this would be the notice that would be deleted because they felt it was redundant, was that it?
And yes.
But as I recall, the hearing on this bill, we had some concerns that we thought the notice might be serving a good purpose in terms of collections.
That's right. So I'm thinking unless this notice seems like something that's redundant or too offensive, we ought to table the bill.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Gardner.
They weren't trying to save money or anything like that. Just trying to avoid nasty phone calls.
Mm-hmm. I think they were adding this notice along with some mail they were sending out already. Isn't that right? So it was mainly a question of whether we wanted them to be that nasty.
Better to be nasty up front rather than...
Well, it's too nasty to inform them that they're not meeting your obligations for child support.
Mr. Chair, I'll move to table.
There you go again, always wanting people, poor people.
I will move to table.
Okay. Please call the roll.
Senator Brown?
No.
Senator Coleman?
Aye.
Senator Frye? Senator Gardner?
Aye.
Senator Hamby?
Aye.
Senator Hendrickson?
Aye.
Senator Wyatt?
Aye. Motion carried. Would you like to be recorded voting on, we just had a motion to table the bill that would eliminate
this
notice.
Aye.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Please record with unanimous consent, we'll record Senator Frye's voting aye. So the bill is tabled. You want to explain your vote?
No, I've changed my vote. I was mesmerized by that orange.
Okay. Senator Brown wants to change the vote to aye. There is an objection. I will by unanimous vote.
I voted no because I was...
The other bill on work session is relating to conservation easements, and we have some amendments here we need to look at quickly. This is one of those bills out of Chicago, no, the Uniform Commission on State Laws bills. Yes, counsel will explain the amendments. Does everyone have them before us? They're in your paper. Senate Bill 197.
Don't you remember when I answered?
Is it the mock-up you're going to need? Yeah. Okay, what's the mock-up?
You should actually have a number of things. You should have a mocked-up copy of the bill, which includes amendments from the state parks people, the Home Builders Association, as well as the Uniform Laws Committee of the Bar. They are not contradictory amendments, except as I've noted at section 2. You should also have copies in your file of the amendments as drafted, so if it's easier for you to look at them. You should also have a copy of letters from the Nature Conservancy and the Bar, and Mr. Bullivan, who you'll remember drafted the Uniform Act, saying that they had no objections to the State Parks and Rec amendments. Basically, what Parks...
Did council get a copy of this letter from Mr. Bullivan addressed to
yes,
me?
Yes, I did. It should be in everyone's file, as a matter of fact.
Right. Mm-hmm.
The problem with the bill as it came up before was that there was no repealer in it. There already existed in Chapter 271, the Public Lands Chapter, and 273, the State Lands Chapter. The existing statutes about conservation easements, you also have a copy of those in your file. All of those things need to be repealed if this bill is enacted. So that's been added in the relating clause. The Home Builders Amendment is at page 1, line 9. The letters from the Uniform Laws Committee, Mr. Bullivant, you'll see, and the Nature Conservancy are all opposed to that amendment. It would require basically conservation easements only in areas that are already designated as conservation or special resource areas in a comprehensive plan.
As I recall, Mr. Chair.
Senator Henderson.
The home builders were concerned, I think, that local governments would require the easements.
They would hold approval kind of hostage until the home builders voluntarily agreed.
And the Nature Conservancy is worried that if we put that restriction on it, then they won't be able to get voluntary easements.
Right. So you'll note on that.
Could you explain the compromise then?
Right. Well, I don't think this is a compromise. Section 7 is the one that's causing all the interest.
Sections 4, 5, and 6 are related to boundaries, territorial boundaries of the utilities. There is some controversy over this.
Just one second on that one. No hearings if they agree to if there's a reallocation of territory, no hearing would be required if all the affected customers agree.
And the two utilities, two or more utilities that were making the contract for service. If they all agree, then...
There's no problem, is there, with... territorial allocation. I mean,
not in section 4.
Well, that's
concerned.
The reason the territorial allocation is immune from antitrust scrutiny under when it's scrutinized by the Public Utility Commissioner is because the Public Utility Commissioner is actively involved in supervision and all that kind of stuff. Territorial allocation, absent such state supervision, is a per se violation of the antitrust laws. Is there any problem? Have you looked at this particular provision from that perspective and satisfied yourself there's no problem?
No, and I'm not capable of...
Do you know what I'm talking about?
I'm not...
if garbage company customers divide up territories, customers, and exchange them, that is a per se violation of the antitrust laws. There's a federal grand jury going right now on that topic. The reason that's not a problem when the PUC does it, supervises an allocation of territory, is because of the presence of state scrutiny. I see one of the lobbyists nodding his head who does recognize I just want to know if you've satisfied yourself that there's no problem with that under this particular provision, or if somebody has looked at it.
It's not come to my attention.
Would somebody look
right
at
now,
that before we pass this out? Could, Mr. Chairman, if we could ask one of the representatives of the utilities to look at that particular issue before it comes, this bill goes out.
Do they have some antitrust lawyers?
There you go, plenty of them.
There are also three witnesses here from telephone companies that are signed up against the bill. That's why I had the humorous exchange. He said this bill is the one that they've just moved the line until there's only one utility in the state. Of course, that was facetious.
But as I said, the first part, Section 4, is simply that we would... All the changes. We wouldn't hold a hearing if everybody is already in agreement.
But it doesn't look like the utilities have to be agreement, just the customers. Section 4.
Well, it may be a misstatement on my part. I assume that the two utilities that were agreeing were already in agreement to make the contract. So the only party that may not have been a party to that would have been the customer or customers to be served.
Boy, I think you're going to look at that.
But the amendment itself, as provided to you, just simply says that all the parties agree that there would not have to be a hearing.
I don't see any amendment, so.
Well, it says if all affected customers approve. That's true. But
why don't we let the can you stay a little minute and we'll ask the opponents and then you can close. How would that be? Since okay. you're the proponent of the bill, you may have not heard all of it. Yeah, Senator Cohen, I don't know if I'm rushing you past anything else that's changed.
Talk about five.
Yes, 5-4.
Yeah, 5-4.
But you have in front of you. I'm sure Kathy's announced the bill, so that
yes.
I don't have to explain it. If you don't.
Well, go ahead. Go ahead. What is 5-4 about?
Section 5, the first part of it is essentially the same as I've just agreed, as I've just testified, in cases where they actually were changing the territorial boundaries by agreement among the utilities, there would not have to be a hearing if the customers agreed. That's the first part. The second part provides that present law does not provide for alteration of the boundaries of any utility that has a boundary allocation, territorial allocation, unless that utility agrees. And if that utility does not agree, then no boundary change can be made. And we've run up against cases where a customer can be served more cost-effectively if the boundary were moved. I cite a case where we received a letter from a gentleman, Milton Freewater, who was told by Pacific Power and Light it cost him almost a little over $4,000 for the connection to his, in this case, a mobile home, to begin to get electricity service. He checked with the Milton Freewater cooperative and was told it would cost, he didn't cite the figure, but it would be less than half that because the amount of line they'd have to run was considerably less. In addition, the rate for service by Umatilla would be less than by PPNL. We're not so concerned with what the rate is, but the fact that you would not need as much line to serve the gentleman, and his cost would be cut by more than half. So in that case, if he could make a case that the boundary should be moved, then the commissioner might say, all right, that sounds reasonable to me, and we'll serve you in a different way. In Perrydale, we have three telephone companies serving Perrydale. People to call a neighbor could be making a call across the street and be going from one telephone company to another. If the law were changed, wouldn't it be feasible for the people of Perrydale to buy the lines that serve them and decide which phone companies they wanted to serve them? In our files a few other cases like that, but I won't bring them all up. We just think that there's some cases where it'd be more cost-effective for a customer to be served by a utility that is able and willing to serve rather than the one in whose territory he happens to be. And the amendment would accomplish that. I recognize that it may give the commissioner considerable power to change boundaries, but nevertheless, we think it's in the public interest for him to be allowed to do that.
Just how far does this go, Mr. Chairman? I mean, conceivably.
Well,
one big district. In a declining cost industry, which this is, doesn't the logic of this lead to the conclusion that that it's probably more reasonable cost-wise to just have one big one? Isn't that the...
I've heard that argument made.
This is the merger bill of...
banks the authority to merge
this is a big one, almost
84 banks in the state.
We could employ additional lawyers to determine what's in the public interest.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator McGregor is suggesting that telephone services on a cost-declining basis
cost.
Now, that argument is made by in no. some quarters.
Yeah. In Section 6, just quickly, the it sets a fee that the utilities pay for various filings. The change we seek to have made here is to eliminate the $100 filing fee when a contract is made by a utility to serve a customer outside its own territory. Since we propose that no hearing be held in such a circumstance, that our cost would not be anywhere near $100, so we think that fee ought to be eliminated. Finally, Section 7 does not really relate to walkways or motor carrier cartage areas. What it does is eliminate from the statutes the bills that have been superseded by the Administrative Procedures Act, laws that related to rulemaking of the Public Utility Commissioner that have been made redundant by the Administrative Procedures Act. Our rulemaking procedure would not be affected in any significant way.
Council.
Well, I wonder if this isn't a mistake in line 10. Do you mean to delete 767.410? I think you went through there and cleaned out all of 756.410. I don't think you mean to take that out. That would make those the regulation of common and contract carriers would, which does not now apply in certain local cartage areas, would come back and apply on them again. I don't know if that's just a typographical. I'm not sure you meant to delete that, and you probably should look at it.
756.410?
Page 4.
767.410.
You page 4, line 10.
Deleting at line 10.
Yes.
I don't mean to hold you up. I just think you should.
Oh, 767.
I think that might be a mistake.
Oh, yes. It is.
You mean 756?
You're going to regulate a whole lot of people you're not regulating now if you do that.
That may be a typographical error, huh?
Yeah. I will have to check that
would
with,
you just
with
let
council.
Me?
Because it's not among the Section 9 laws being repealed.
Okay. Thank you.
Are there any other questions? I've asked council to advise Mr. Maudlin a few days ago or a week ago. Think that at least I've been talking to council about the possible amendment.
Yes.
This relating clause relating to the Public Utility Commissioner, and a concern I've had for three sessions, I think, is that the language defining the job of the Public Utility Commissioner says they shall serve it for a term of years. And shall only be removed for cause, but it says the governor may at any time remove the commissioner for any cause deemed by him sufficient. Should be by the governor is sufficient. Before such removal, he shall give the commissioner a copy of the charge against him, shall fix a time when he can be heard in his own defense, and shall not, which shall not be less than 10 days thereafter. The hearing shall be open to the public. If the commissioner is removed, the governor shall file in the office of Secretary of State a complete statement of all charges made against the commissioner and his findings thereon, with a record of the proceedings. Such power of removal is absolute, and as there is no right of review of the same in any court. So it starts out by saying they'll only be removed for cause, then it proceeds to say they can have a hearing only in front of the governor, and you can't the governor's power is absolute. So this is a legislative round and round passed in 1973, which really says the Public Utility Commissioner serves at the pleasure of the governor. And it's, I think, a misleading. This is certainly goes way before Senator Attia, so this is no reflection on him. But it misleads the public, I believe, to call it a Public Utility Commissioner. That sounds like a commission, some kind of an independent body that's out there protected from the compromising influences of the shifting winds of politics, and then have them serve at the pleasure. So all the governor has to do is say, do it my way or you're gone. And I'm working on an amendment that would say that they serve for a term of years and they would only be removed for cause, and that cause would have to be for defined reasons, such as misfeasance in office.
And there would be a right to an actual hearing. And I don't want to take any time in the committee today with this, but I just want to let you know that that's a possible amendment that we're working on. Now,
if you get on my bill, does that improve my chances for Section 4, 5, or 6?
I think it does.
It improves the bill's chances.
I thought maybe if we deleted the language after line 5 on page 1 and put my amendment in, it might improve it faster. I don't know.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mari Ostley, Astley, Oregon Independent Telephone Association. Would you want either of the other two people to come up with you? I notice they're both from telephone companies, too. Are you?
Mr. Chairman, we can do it either way you'd like. Those two gentlemen represent two companies that were involved in a situation the commissioner was concerned with last session and when he originally asked for this power. And I thought it might help to have those two people here talk about the situation and their views.
Well, that would be nice if we could have them all at once, because we want to leave here in 7 minutes. So,
okay.
Ken Sandner, is that S-A-U or S-A-N-D-N-E-R? S-A-N-D-N-E-R.
Ken Sandner and Boyd Spiker.
And Boyd Spiker. Go ahead.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am Maury Astley, Executive Vice President of the Oregon Independent Telephone Association. I represent the 30 Oregon telephone companies that are not affiliated with the Bell system. I'm here today to oppose one portion of Senate Bill 202. That portion, if passed, would permit the Public Utility Commissioner to realign utility territorial boundaries in a manner different from the current law allows. Among my companies are 11 co-ops and 8 family-owned companies. 22 of my companies have only one telephone switching center. 12 of them serve less than 1,000 telephones. So we're talking about some small companies that would be affected by this kind of thing. The fixed territory boundaries are very important to small company operations. The small companies have the same technical problems that the large companies have when they must move boundaries and serve areas out of different central offices. However, more critical to small companies is the effect on financing and the ability to pay back loans. A company's ability to pay debts is based on projected customers and revenues. If a portion of the territory is removed, it jeopardizes a company's ability to pay these debts. The territory allocation question came up last session for two reasons. The commissioner wanted an additional tool to resolve service problems, and some customers wanted to transfer to a larger free calling area. We explained then that the commissioner and customers have means to address these problems without this legislation. Through the use of hearings and negotiations, the Charbonneau area of Wilsonville was studied and for additional cost was placed in the Portland calling area. The service problems in Sile were resolved by telephone company board action taken after public hearings, and additional improvements in telephone equipment were made and a new switch was ordered. With increasing pressure on our industry due to competition and deregulation, it is vital that we retain the basic component of our business, and that's our local dial tone customer. Political jurisdictions are in a constant state of flux, and it is not possible for telephone companies to keep up with these changes. This bill is aimed at problems that can be resolved through other means. Our concern is a precedent could be set which would create many problems for our industry. Because of these problems, we urge you to make the amendments which I've attached, and that would delete those portions of page 1, line 2 that address the law, and on page 3, delete lines 8 through 40, and on page 4, delete lines 1 to 3. And I'd like to just mention that a couple of things that Gene Modlin talked about. In light of what I was just saying about means to do what the commissioner wants to do through existing hearings and other cases. In the case where there's an area that can be served more economically or expeditiously by another utility, we have made agreements to do that. We're talking about where the commissioner wants to make a change that the companies do not want to make. There are situations that come up. For example, in some of the rural areas, maybe there's customers that haven't had service or they've been served in a partial way, and we've determined that the best way to provide them is to have another company come in. Maybe they're a little closer or they have some facilities that are near enough to be extended. In those cases, we've been willing to do that. Charbonneau is a good case where a community developed after city boundaries and telephone company boundaries were already in place, and then they wanted to be included in the other telephone company's boundary because it was a larger free calling area. It gave them Portland if they could have moved from telephone utilities into general telephone. The problem was resolved by finding out what kind of additional cost would be incurred to have those people have that free calling area. They picked up a large part of it, and the remainder was spread over the rest of the Portland customers. So that solved the problem of people who wanted to get a free calling area. It wasn't necessary to give that territory to anybody else. And the same with the situation with these two gentlemen's company. There was an area that was out some distance from the SIO central office, and they basically wanted a better service, and they wanted to be able to have a free calling area into Staten, which was a little closer to their community. And the hearings process brought out that there was a need to improve the cable and the switch. And that company, after those hearings, made a decision to vote the money to go to REA and get a loan. And they are now in the process of putting in that new plan. This is a co-op company owned by the people, and it had been their decision in the past to go slow on investing new capital. But it got to a situation where the commissioner got involved and the people made the change. So we think that the existing law can solve the kinds of problems without giving additional new powers to the commissioner. There was a question earlier of Gene on the antitrust situation. We would be concerned if Bell, for example, or General Telephone were to be given new territories. There's been court cases and rulings in the past of precluded them from getting additional territory. And normally what happens in a situation like this is the commissioner is involved in, it would be a situation where territory is traded. In the case of maybe someone who needs to be filed or needs to be served and can be better served by Bell, then they would trade some other territory to that small company so that there could be a realignment of boundaries. So we have had those situations, but we would be concerned if we're just decide to give up 500 customers for one of my companies and decide to have that served by Bell, I think there would be a concern over whether that'd be allowed. That's all I have. If you have some particular questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
One question, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Frye.
I just wonder how you might handle the situation that was proposed there, explained by Mr. Maudlin on the fellow at Milton Freewater, where obviously he was going to have to pay substantial amount more to one utility than he would to the other one.
Yes, we have some situations that occur, particularly in the rural areas, where maybe a temporary facility has been hooked up with Bell because they happen to have a toll cable, something that's not normally used for customers, but happened to go through that desert area. And in the end, it was decided the best way to do that would be to give that piece of territory to Bell, and then something in closer to the central office was traded to the company. But on that point, what I said is that we have voluntarily agreed in those situations where there was an additional expense or a situation where a customer could be served more economically by a different company. There have been trades involved where one portion of the territory would be given to the company that could serve that inexpensively, and then another piece of territory traded to that company. So there was no net loss to that company. But it's done on a voluntary basis, and we do it. We've had situations in the last year or two where that's taken place. We don't insist that customer has to pay that high cost just because it's our one customer out there. We have been willing to work on those kind of problems in the past.
Mr. Massey, if we may take a look on page 3, the amendments to Section 4, as I read those amendments, the current law gives, let's say, adjoining utilities the right to enter into a contract for a boundary change, but apparently there may be, under the current law, a requirement for a hearing. And all I see that line 12 on page 3 does is to delete the hearing requirement if all the affected customers are agreeable. Do you find anything objectionable in that language? I'm just now limiting my comments to lines 8
2.13.
It just says customers, does it not?
But I think it presupposes, at least as I read it, presupposes that the adjoining utilities have entered into a contract.
Well, Senator Brown, we don't feel there's any real need to change the existing law. I don't think we'd press that hard if you feel it's necessary to eliminate the hearing requirement. I don't think we'd have that much difficulty with it.
Well, as I read it, and I may be reading it in error, is that...
I don't know whether that says that there's no hearing required if the customers agree.
Yes, yes. And that,
but that doesn't tell me what happens if the companies don't agree.
Yes.
If both the companies agree and the customers agree, then I would see there's probably no need for that hearing. But I think all parties have to be in agreement, or we need some hearings to open up the discussion.
See, but at the end of line 12, it talks in terms of no hearing is required if all effective customers approve the amendatory agreement. I think it presupposes that there is an agreement. Mm-hmm.
In that case, Senator Brown, I would say we'd probably be willing to accept that.
Yes. Then I just discovered lines 25 to 27 as I was sitting here. I gather
that's the main concern of us, is it gives him the power to move territories without our approval or
yes.
agreement.
Thank you. Senator Cohen, any questions?
No, I just, Mr. Chairman, I guess if we define it really narrowly, would you still have a problem with that? I'm talking about making sure that we re-amended it to make sure that none of these changes could materially affect your financing and the ability to pay debts of one company over another company, something of that order, or to really limit it in a way that, or would you still see that as being an intrusion into the what now is a sacred...
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senator Cohen, I don't think you could define that narrowly enough. I would still be very concerned. The commissioner himself has said he would see that as he would only use it in limited situations. But it's my feeling is it's unnecessary. We solve the kind of problems that he states, and so there isn't any need to give him that additional power.
Okay, thank you.
If the Eastern Oregon situation occurred and the two adjoining utilities we're not willing to make that's trade of a customer, not trade, it's a transfer of the customer. Is there any provision of the current law for the unhappy customer who's going to have to pay the $4,000 for service rather than the $2,000, the higher rates rather than the lower rates, to get some sort of a public hearing, some sort of a day in court to discuss his plight?
He can still ask for a public hearing on the issue, and the commissioner can still make some related decisions as to the way the service should be provided or how the cost should be spread within the limits of the existing tariffs and rules.
But the current law gives him at least the right to request a hearing.
Oh, yes, he can have a hearing today. In this example I stated before in Sile, he did do that. He called hearings because of some complaints by customers, and through a series of hearings and decisions by that company, then the problem was resolved.
Any further discussion or questions?
Okay, just quickly, if you'd like, I'll have the other two people
yes,
state their names and testimony.
Sandler, I gather the ladies in the middle.
Yes, my name is Ken Sandler, and I am manager of State and Cooperative Telephone Company. We serve about 4,000 customers in states of Lindy, Marion, and the surrounding area. Being a cooperative, our company is owned by the customer, and I am here in their behalf. We are opposed to the sections in this bill which would allow the Public Utility Commissioner to reallocate utility company territory. The first reason is the design and cost of facilities. Now, I have attached on the back sheet a diagram which I'd like to call your attention to. The attached chart is a very simple diagram showing two telephone companies and their central offices. Notice that the cable plant starts out very large from the central office and tapers down to nothing at the exchange boundary. The left side of the diagram shows the cable plant as it exists before a boundary change, and the right side shows what happens after boundary change. The red section of cable plant cannot be used by Company A, but must still be paid for by Company A's customers, which are now fewer in number. The yellow section of cable plant must be built new and paid for by Company B's customers. Also, Company A's customers must pay for the excess central office equipment they now have. Company B's customers must pay for additional central office equipment to serve its new customers. The second reason we oppose reallocation of territory is financing. Our company and most telephone companies use long-term financing. Ours happens to be 35 years. The lending institutions would be very reluctant to loan to us if there was some doubt about the area and the number of customers we might be serving in the future.
Thank you.
Only a brief comment. I enjoyed your visuals. For those of us that right hemisphericity takes over on occasion.
Thank you.
It's excellent.
And Mr. Boyd Spiker from SIO, Mutual Telephone Association.
Yes, sir. What the other two gentlemen have said pretty well sums up our case, and what I have is about a repetition of that. The only thing that I feel that I had to offer was that we did experience a case that was solved through the current methods of dealing with it in hearings. I think that what happened in that case was that we came up with a rapid solution, and it was a good solution. I don't think that it could have been improved upon by granting the commissioner any additional authority. I believe that the commission office is also happy with the solution we came up with at this time. So, in a nutshell, this would hurt our ability to plan, and I don't see that it's necessary to increase those powers, because we already have methods to deal with those types of problems that are fairly effective.
Thank you, Mr. Spiker. Any questions of Mr. Boyd Spiker?
No, Mr. Chairman,
yes.
I just say thanks for the written testimony. I assume that that's the only few lines of the bill that you object to.
Yes. We don't have any objection with the other portions of the bill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And again, if it's crystal clear that in that one provision on page 3, section 4, that the companies would have to concur in that, fully concur, voluntarily concur, you'd have no problem.
No, Senator Brown, if I have any problem with